My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Start by telling you that nothing beats a New England fall, but you already know. You already know that fall here means pumpkin treats, biting into a freshly made cider donut, and enjoying some tailgate fun with family and friends. What you might not know is that Big Y has all your local fall favorites, from local produce and comfort foods to floral and game day eats and everything in between. But now you know, so visit your local Big Y. It's more than food. It's my Big Y.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Thomas Halliday, paleontologist, evolutionary biologist, writing Other Lands, A Journey Through Earth's Extinct World. 41 million years ago, it's warm. It's very warm. There's no ice on the planet to be found. We're looking at the dawn of the recent, to how to understand this. Now, we've paid attention to land creatures. Thomas takes us to Seymour Island and gigantic penguins. Where is it, Thomas? Where was it then and where is it today?
Well, fortunately, it hasn't actually moved all that much in the intervening millions of years. Seymour Island is today a small island off the West Antarctic Peninsula. So it's the site of Antarctic research bases. It's that the West Antarctic Peninsula is that spit of Antarctica which stretches up towards South America. And at the time, it was, you know, still part of this this peninsula. And what was different, of course, is at that time it was a little bit closer to South America, and the stretch of water that currently separates them, which is today known as the Drake Passage, had only just opened up. And that was something that was going to have huge impacts on the environment of particularly Antarctica, but the world as a whole. By opening up the Drake Passage, you get the circumpolar current, which is this oceanic current that goes all the way around Antarctica and doesn't get stopped by any sort of continental landmass. And because this opened up, this is the point at which Antarctica begins to cool down. You get a separation of the weather system of the South Pole and prevents the sort of exchange of warmth with the tropics. And as such, you know, glaciers begin to emerge in the mountains of Antarctica and spread out across the whole of that continent. But before that glaciation happened, Antarctica, Seymour Island in particular, but large parts of it, was composed of a temperate rainforest with these sort of wonderfully diverse several species of penguin, but also mammal communities and a verdant forest ecosystem.
Yes, the albatross. Was the albatross bigger? Everything's bigger back then. Was it bigger now, or did it have the same habits of flying all day and sleeping on the ocean?
I don't know. I don't think that albatrosses necessarily were around there, but there is a bird that is a very good analogue of an albatross. So it's got the same kind of ecological behaviour of the modern albatross, and these are the pelagornithids. That's a word which literally means ocean bird. But they're also known as pseudo-toothed birds because they have these weird sort of bony projections along their beaks, which help them to, you know, snatch slippery fish and squid from the water surface as they're hunting. But like an albatross, they have these incredibly long but narrow wings. And so the same kind of flight pattern that you see in an albatross today of dynamic soaring, where they use the wind to help them to gain height again after sort of falling down, it would have had this a very similar sort of oceanic lifestyle. And indeed, we know from the fact that the juveniles don't have these sort of hunting enabling bony spurs on their beaks that there was extended parental care, right? They weren't able to hunt for themselves. So it's similar to albatrosses, you have some of the most sort of rigorous parenting strategies of any animal around today.
The Earth is much warmer. Plus 5 degrees centigrade is my note here from your reporting. And there are 800 parts per million of CO2. So does this qualify as greenhouse Earth, or is that in the distant past?
No, this is absolutely greenhouse Earth. So there are essentially two stable states that have existed across Earth history. So we think of this greenhouse Earth where there is no permanent ice at the poles, which is true of the Eocene, and then this icehouse Earth where there is permanent ice at the poles. So from a technical geological perspective, we are still in an ice age. I know that's not how people tend to use it colloquially, but from a sort of scientific perspective, right now is still an ice age. It's just an interglacial within it. And that plus 5 degrees, I mean, it will vary through different latitudes. So what tends to happen when the Earth gets warmer is that the poles get significantly warmer, and then the equatorial regions get a bit warmer. But you get a greater evening out of temperatures around the world.
And the emperor lizard, my note says Basilosaurid. Is that a whale? Is that what happens?
Yeah, Basilosaurus is the first whale that is sort of really fully aquatic. So whales evolved in what is now India and Pakistan a little earlier than this chapter is set. And they were, you know, coastal predators essentially, and fulfilled a seal-like niche, you might think. And then they get progressively sort of further into the ocean. And Basilosaurus, it has that name, emperor lizard, as you said, because when it was first discovered, it was assumed to be a marine reptile, a sort of sea serpent. You know, it's got these flexible vertebrae that meant that, you know, it's got this sort of eel-like style of swimming, kind of Loch Ness monster-y, you might imagine. But absolutely, we know for sure that it is a whale. It's an extraordinarily long, sort of narrow whale. So although not quite as massive as a blue whale, it rivals it for length.
My note says that it's growing colder. This is the twilight months. So the warming is not lasting. Is that correct? We're moving towards the ice that you've indicated.
In this chapter, it's getting colder because it's going into winter. I mean, one of the most remarkable things about this idea, and really the reason I wanted to write about it, is we have a temperate rainforest in Antarctica, right, which is completely different from what we expect. But of course, the planet still goes around the sun in the same kind of way. So we still have 3 months of total darkness happening at this latitude, and we still have 3 months of total day. So what happens to a temperate rainforest when there is no light for 3 months? You know, what do the plants do? Well, they're going to aspirate, essentially. They're going to hibernate, rather. They're going to drop their leaves and stop photosynthesizing. But there are big animals there in this ecosystem, and it's a diverse place. So I wanted to sort of explore the inhabitants of this world as we get into, you know, the days of, well, not midnight sun, the absolute opposite of midnight sun, as we get into the time when the sun goes away for several months at a time.
Yes, let's go to that right away, because this is the spectacular event. This is, Hollywood could not have invented this. We're going to Hell's Creek, Montana, the Paleocene. And this is the event that we now understand was an asteroid/comet striking the Earth in such a way that it set fires across most of the canopy, I think, were destroyed. This event, hypothetical, Thomas, without this event, does everything change? In other words, other lands are possible without this event? Is that a way to reason how sudden this was? Because other mass extinctions that we'll touch upon seem to be produced by either volcanic activity or climate change, but this event is exogenous to all the other mass extinctions.
Yeah, this is the most recent of the mass extinctions, and it is certainly very different from the others. There was, you know, a terrible single day of cataclysm, which then had long-lasting effects. You have a piece of rock, you know, the size of a small town, hitting into what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and it struck a place where there happened to be a lot of oil under the ocean, and so sent a lot of soot up into the atmosphere. We can find this soot across other continents, having been deposited, and trace it back to this site. Similarly, the reason that we know it's an asteroid is because there is this iridium layer. The element iridium is not found commonly on Earth, but it is commonly found on these extraterrestrial rocks. And this layer sort of indicates the point at which you have this huge extinction. But all of this material blasted up into the atmosphere darkened the skies, and photosynthesis, the process by plants turning light into food, doesn't happen for an order of years. And this is, you know, extremely destructive, especially to ecosystems on land, but just also in general. I mean, pretty much nothing bigger than a small dog survives. And not that dogs were around at that time, but as a sort of idea of scale.
You take us to 30,000 years after the event. Why that? Yes. Why that date? Because right now we're looking at something called the placentals and eutherians. What were those, Thomas?
Well, we are placental mammals. We are eutherian mammals. The placental mammals are one of the main divisions of mammals, and we are the ones that have long-term internal gestation. So long pregnancy, that is a result of us being placentals. The others being, of course, platypuses and echidnas, which lay eggs, and marsupials, which have very, very short internal gestation, and then the rest are in the pouch. But this is the point at which we get the first definitively placental mammal fossils, is immediately after this mass extinction event. And in a geological sense, when we say immediately, I'm going to the earliest that we can go, which is 30,000 years after the event. We have a relative uncertainty. And actually, so anyone who's listening and recognizes the name Hell Creek will maybe associate it more with the Cretaceous, the time before this mass extinction event, and Tyrannosaurus Rex is famously from this site. But it does extend a bit, that same rock formation extends a little bit into the Paleocene. So I wanted to look very specifically at this site after the dinosaurs have gone and as mammals begin to diversify.
Did the placentals, the eutherians, true beasts, did they exist before the event and survived in some fashion because there was a food for them, or there was a way to get through those, what'd you say, 2 years of darkness?
Yeah, one way of surviving is by being small, and all eutherians. So when we talk about eutherians as opposed to placentals, what we mean is eutherians are everything that is more closely related to us than to marsupials. Placentals are everything that is more closely related to one kind of living placental mammal than another kind of living placental mammal. So it's a slight technical distinction there. But there were certainly eutherian mammals before the Cretaceous mass extinction, but only the ones that survive today seem to have diversified after that event. So being small helps. Being sort of insectivorous as opposed to requiring large amounts of meat or large amounts of plant material is very helpful because insects didn't do too badly at that extinction event. Burrowing is hugely important for these big swings of temperature because if you burrow, you have a relatively stable environment. I mean, there are evidence of rodents near, you know, Los Alamos, the nuclear testing ground, that survived nuclear blasts despite their burrows only being about a foot under the ground, right? Burrowing, it can be an extremely sensible way of surviving environmental fluctuations, and many of these eutherian mammals would have been doing that sort of thing.
So what we're looking at then is the survival of the creatures that were small enough and clever enough and lucky enough to find a way to get through the darkness, and the dinosaurs could not, the largest animals. Is this true for North America, for the upper northern hemisphere? Is it also true for the island continent? Well, it was island. It's now joined with North America. The island continent of South America. Did those dinosaurs go away as well?
This is the point. Worldwide, you lose the dinosaurs and other large animals within the ecosystem. Yeah. As ever, paleontology is extremely, the data we have is extremely biased towards North America and Europe because that's where scientists have been working for the longest. It's where countries are wealthy enough to be able to afford to have paleontologists in their society and have had that for longest. So there is a little bit of a dearth of data from the global south, but that is changing. Even so, we still haven't found any of these placental mammals from earlier in the Cretaceous, and we don't find anything dinosaurian or, you know, similar ecologically after the mass extinction event.
I'm speaking with Thomas Halliday. The book is Other Lands, A Journey Through Earth's Extinct Lands. We're going to China, what is China today, and the Cretaceous period, right before the asteroid comet strikes.
People often ask, what's next? At Torrington Savings Bank, we think the real question is, what if? What if you had a financial partner who genuinely cared about getting you from where you are today to where you want to be tomorrow? We're that partner.
Whether you want to simplify your banking, make your next move, or prepare for next quarter, we're with you all the way. So stop by, because tomorrow looks great from here. Torrington Savings Bank. Member FDIC.
I'm Renee Danino for iHeart Communities. This Veterans Day, we partnered with Big Y, your family market, to share ways you can support veterans here in our state. Joining us now, Connecticut VA Commissioner Saudi on ways veterans in need in our state can receive help.
They can go to the Connecticut Department of Veterans Affairs website. Programs are there and links to federal supportive programs as well. And if there is a veteran in crisis, the veteran, a family member, or colleague can call the crisis line 24/7 at 800-273-8255 and press 1.